Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. Cradle-to-grave biographies are no longer the only way to tell a life story. In fact, contemporary biographies come in many forms. Today you will be hearing from two very creative storytellers, Caitlin Cass, a graphic biographer, and Lisa Napoli on group biography. The first half of this episode features an interview I had with Caitlin Cass about her book Suffrage Song, The Haunted History of Gender, Race, and Voting Rights in the U.S., It was published by Fantagraphics in 2024 and was named Best Art Book of 2024 by Hyperallergic. I spoke with Caitlin by Zoom on February 5th, 2025, and began my conversation by asking about her journey into the genre.
Well, I started out making history comics that mostly poked fun at dead white guys. I studied the classics. I did great books in college. So that was the thrust of my work, and failure throughout Western history was what my work was focused on. But then after I got out of graduate school, I started teaching at an all-girls high school. And so there was increasingly this need to like represent women and people of color in my work so that it would reflect the student body. And so there was like a slow move towards being more inclusive in the histories I was telling. And maybe also a maturing, you know, not just wanting to criticize, but also trying to build something that was happening. And a local curator and archivists at the Birchfield Penny, where I was living in Buffalo, New York, reached out because they collected my comics. I do a monthly comic that I mail out to people. It's bi-monthly now. It started as monthly. And they were looking for someone to apply for one of the suffrage centennial grants. And so since there was already that move in my work, they reached out to me. And so that was really where the project began. It began as something that was going to exist in the gallery space and online and in a publication all at once. I do not think they thought it would become a full-size scale graphic novel, but it just kept finding more people I needed to include. So it continued to grow from there and eventually even grew beyond the scope of that exhibition because I made another 100 pages after that exhibition was over to create this like 260-page graphic history.
It's a beautiful book. It's got pullouts. It's got folded maps. You've got a character list. It's in chapters and sections, and you have it color-coded. It's really easy to follow this narration throughout. And then in the back, you have a whole bibliography, plus you have archives and collections, different organizations and songs that you've quoted in the book. Tell me about the different archives and collections that you visited for this book.
I was able to do, I would say, the bulk of the research online and through books and traditional articles. But I did visit archives at first just for the local history because that stuff wasn't able to find it in books. So when I was beginning, it was with Buffalo. The museum I was working with was a regional museum. So I really wanted to feature the history of Western New York and the suffrage movement. So it began there. I went to the Buffalo Historical Society to look at some original documents and to find some figures to highlight. And then it kind of continued to grow. So I used a lot of online archives from the Library of Congress to the SNCC Digital Gateway, which is amazing. I couldn't have done this project without. They've just collected all of these amazing original documents from the civil rights movement, just extensive biographies of all of these different like figures, no matter how small their part in this movement, which really helped me navigate my way through it. Because there are over 36 activists that are like actually represented with some level of biography. And there are a lot more that have guest appearances in the book too. And then I went to the Vassar archive. I looked at a bunch of their suffrage materials, but that was mostly like visual fodder at the time. I was in residence at Women's Studio Workshop, so I was making etchings inspired by Godey's Lady Book and the visual representation of women during the Civil War and the ways that these fashion magazines sort of curated what women could talk about and specifically avoided talking about politics because it was so taboo for women to talk about it at the time. And so using those as fodder to create, you know, maybe more summative statements about these stereotypes that existed and the difficulty of combating them when they were so instilled in the popular consciousness and in the popular media. I did use some microfiche at the UNO library once I moved out here to teach in Nebraska and Omaha. And they have Fannie Lou Hamer's, a bunch of her papers on microfiche. And so I checked those out as well. And it's interesting to see like what was saved because a lot of it is sympathy cards and birthday cards and stuff from that towards the end of her life. But they're from people like John Lewis. It was very fun to look through.
One of my favorite things about this book is that you capture these costumes, these elaborate, they're almost time capsules of these costumes that I think in a traditional biography, it's hard to capture that. The bustles and the bonnets and the eyeglasses. And you capture these details that I think are difficult to describe in a traditional biography. What are some of the things that you can include in your graphic art that you can't convey in a traditional biography, like traditional book biography?
So much. For one thing, I'm really convinced as a visual artist, as somebody who studied visual studies as a grad student, that the visual culture of a time period is just like ingrained into people's heads. So I think there's like ways in which like unconsciously, you know, the print media, the newspapers, the typography of the time period informs the thinking. So it was really important to me to reflect that in the work. And as far as like the costumes, I can think of just things you don't even really think about if you're just writing. You start to just notice more because you're having to visualize the everyday lives of these people. And like the dresses, for example, as they were like traveling out west to like Kansas, where there weren't paved roads, and like walking through the dirt, the dresses would just like catch all this dirt and trash and, you know, manure on the bottoms of them. And to just like just conceive of the fact that people were still dressing like that, even when it was just like wildly impractical, is fascinating to me. So like there's a section that's about the freedom dress and the reason the women tried to wear the bloomers and the sort of failure of that, at least with the early suffrage movement, because of just how radically they were not listened to because of that, you know, how they just were seen as ridiculous. And so eventually, at least Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony went back to wearing dresses so that they would be taken more seriously.
You have a cast of characters in this book that's a really beautiful fold out. And this cast of characters includes people from Lucretia Mott to Frederick Douglass to Ida B. Wells. How did you decide to narrow down this cast of characters when over the course of 150 years, there must have been hundreds of people that you had to choose for this biography?
A lot of things. One was for a longer biography, it needed to be someone that there were multiple sources on them. You know, like I don't have a history degree. There's only such an extent of original research I wanted to be doing because I wanted to make sure I was pulling from the academic sources that already existed. I wanted to try to encapsulate all the research I was doing, but to build that from scratch was just a little bit outside of the purview of what was possible for me, you know? So I did do the original research for local people that didn't have those histories, but like for the main three, I would say in the book are Susan B. Anthony, Alice Paul, and Fannie Lou Hamer. And what's interesting is when I started the project, there really weren't very many biographies about Fannie Lou Hamer. And by the time I got to the end of the project, there were two excellent biographies of Fannie Lou Hamer. And so that was like so helpful. And then just like the increased amount around the suffrage centennial of civil rights and women and voting rights, just different recorded interviews and things from Charles McLaurin and other people made that possible. And then I wanted everyone obviously to be connected to voting rights. So Alice Paul seemed important to include. I chose Susan B. Anthony instead of Elizabeth Cady Stanton as like the main person because I think she really wrestled more with racism in her thinking than Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who I think was somebody who was really willing to say and believe whatever it needed to be believed in order to get the vote for women, used the patriarchal ideas in order to her advance her own ideas. You know, those women started fighting for the right to vote alongside Black men and Black women. And then once the movement decided to prioritize the Black male vote during Reconstruction, they decided to break off and focus instead on women by themselves, and even collaborated with George Francis Train, who was like a very public racist who was always making a sort of public scene. And I found more material about Susan B. Anthony's wrestling with those ideas than I did about Elizabeth Cady Stanton. So I wanted to focus on that.
You have this motif of ghosts throughout this book. In the beginning, you open the book with kind of a personal essay, as it were, or a personal graphic essay about why you decide to take on this project. And the history of this movement has ghosts, right? And you conjure up these ghosts in the beginning. And then throughout the narrative, there are ghosts that, you know, show up throughout this book. And then in the end, you, I don't want to give anything away, but those ghosts come back and haunt us in the end, which I think is really beautifully done. And I wonder why you chose this motif of ghosts.
The ghosts first emerged out of this overlap between suffrage and spiritualism. So there were a lot of early women's rights activists that were also spiritualists, in part because spiritualism was a place where they could speak in public and it wasn't as taboo because they were channeling dead white guys. So I was interested in that. And the Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually wrote the Declaration of Sentiments on a seance table that is now in the Smithsonian Museum. They don't note that it was a seance table, but there's letters where she talks about like channeling the spirit of the revolution. And it's hard to know the degree to which, you know, that was sort of a poetic twist on words or how much she actually believed it. Maybe like a little bit of a mix, right? So I really found that fascinating. And so that's when I first found the ghosts. And when I'm writing histories, I'm always like trying to find something that's going to like push the imagination, the incredulity of the reader so that they maybe like look more closely and like read a little harder to figure out what the fact and the fiction is. In part because I know, and a lot of the book is about like the complexities of writing history and how you can't really like escape bias. And so like trying to instill that kind of critical reading is so important to me. And of course, as I kept working on it, like through the pandemic, through George Floyd, like through all of this, I really wanted to start incorporating these ideas of just the unfinished business of the women's rights movement and racism within the women's rights movement. And I just started, of course, seeing ghosts everywhere in just like post-colonial theory and like ideas of being haunted by empire. Ann Laura Stoller's book, which I reference in the introduction. And then there's also, of course, references to ghosts in a lot of other materials. So Isabel Wilkerson is also referenced. So they become an expansive visual metaphor for the unfinished business of the suffrage movement.
Somehow in your art, you're able to capture this unsayable thing, especially in the Fannie Lou Hamer story. You just capture this intensity. What are some of the things that you have to leave out as a result of writing a graphic biography?
Well, I mean, you just have to distill the information into a much smaller space. It can't be as many facts and details, like choosing the pithiest quotes, which can be really hard because there's people just used to use so many words, So like that's an example. But I want to see it as like a positive thing, just that it's a different way. I mean, the biographies of many of these people have already been written, and that was what enabled me to do the group biography and to hope that the reader could kind of help fill in some of the gaps, like allowing that sort of, what in traditional prose is like white space to kind of hold the weight of just the length of this struggle. And how long it's gone on and how it continues to this day, like by creating that space through juxtaposition of imagery or through just juxtaposition of stories or the way that, even panel to panel imagery, like things can be left in the gutter that can be left up to the viewer or reader to try to piece together. And I think there's a power in that that is not utilized as much in academic writing because the point is to explicate and not to leave creative gaps, right? But I think that's where the emotive power is often held is in the unsaid.
That was Caitlin Cass talking with me via Zoom on February 5th, 2025, about her graphic biography, Suffrage Song, The Haunted History of Gender, Race, and Voting Rights in the U.S. It was published by Fantagraphics in 2024. Next up is my conversation on March 31st, 2025, on Zoom with bio member Lisa Napoli, who was one of the founders of this podcast. Her group biography, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, was published in 2022 by Adams Press. I asked her what led her to write about these four women, and this is what she had to say.
Well, I had just written a book the year before that had come out about Ted Turner and the making of CNN. And of course, Ted Turner and the making of CNN wasn't just about Ted Turner or CNN. It was about a moment in time that gave birth to the 24-hour news revolution that was really indelibly tied to technology and just a hunger for more information. So I finished that book, and my editor at Abrams said, "I love working with you. What else you got?" And I said, I don't have anything else. I'm exhausted. And he said, "Well, actually, I'm interested in Koki Robert. She just died. She's, super famous journalist who worked in every medium. She was beloved, died an untimely death of breast cancer. Maybe you should write a biography of her." And I said, "All right, let me think about it." So I started fishing around and I said to a colleague of mine, because I used to work in radio, "What do you think about a biography of Koki Roberts?" And my friend said, "Man, you just wrote a book about the 40th anniversary of CNN. NPR's 50th anniversary is coming up. And Koki was one of the founding mothers with Susan, Linda, and Nina. That's what you should write about." And that's why I wrote the book. The story of Koki is a fascinating story. She's, an incredible woman who came from wealth and privilege. Her parents had very varied backgrounds themselves, and she really only wanted to be a housewife. And after she was a housewife and mother for a few years, her husband was a well-regarded journalist at the New York Times. She decided she wanted more than that. So her story is an interesting prong in this larger story of NPR, because that was the place where she made her first imprint. And then, of course, it also became a story, because this was all happening in the 70s, about second wave feminism, because you couldn't extricate the fact that the creation of public broadcasting in the late 60s was happening at the same time that second wave feminism was bubbling up. And these four women embodied that. So all of these stories braided together into one kind of interesting story about the birth of an iconic media outlet that few people seem to know the history of.
It's almost a biography of NPR with these women's stories woven in a sense, which kind of answers my question about a braiding narrative. But I wanted to know, you had written a biography on Joan Kroc, and you had written this biography on Ted Turner at CNN. you've always had a single subject. So what was it like writing a group biography? What was the research process like? Can you tell me a little bit about researching for women as opposed to just a single subject?
Well, actually, no, I've never written a single subject biography, and no one really does, to be honest. I mean, even if it does seem like it is. Ray and Joan was about Joan Kroc, the wife of the man who popularized McDonald's. I wanted to write a book mostly centered on her. I couldn't sell that book because nobody knew who she was. And plus, they wanted to know the backstory. How did this woman become incredibly well off? How did her husband make the money? You couldn't tell the story about a great under-recognized philanthropist of the 20th century without looking at where the money came from. And where the money came from was a huge, important, whether you love it or hate it, company that's a worldwide brand, now a worldwide brand. What were its roots? And with Ted Turner, as I mentioned before, it's not just about Ted Turner and the making of CNN. It's about all of these people who came together. In fact, it's almost, Ted Turner isn't secondary, but they're all the people who worked with him to make CNN happen were people who convinced him that the news business was worth pursuing. Ted Turner thought news was stupid when he started CNN. He even said that. He said nobody cares about the news. He said a lot of other things too. So yeah, and my first book is about Bhutan and how I went to help start a radio station there, but it's not about me or the radio station, or about the ascent of democratic rule in Bhutan. It's about the impact of technology and media culture on an otherwise secluded Buddhist kingdom. So there's never not a group biography. But to answer your question, in this case, I had four women. I chose to look at the history of NPR through the lens of these four women who were inarguably the driving force behind it. They were not in charge. There were men in charge. And there were many people, of course, who made NPR NPR. But these women were there at a moment in time when nobody cared or knew about NPR. And so their each of their individual stories, which were each very different, led you to this place at this moment in time. And so researching that was tough, especially since it was during the pandemic, and especially since basically all four stories, I had to do it very quickly. I think, a little over a year to write that book. So it was a killer. It literally was a killer. I'm still alive, but it was tough to do, but it was a gratifying experience.
In a world filled with so much noise and distraction, how do you stay focused on your craft if you only have a year to write a biography, let's say?
Well, even if you have 5 years to write one, you just have to make the time and commitment to get it done. And of course, a deadline helps us all get anything done. And some people only operate that way. And having worked in the news business for many years, I was used to quick, 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 quick deadlines. So this year, I knew it wasn't a lot, but it's definitely different than 20 minutes from now. But I was really fortunate because when I started doing the book, I wrote to the three living women and I said, I want to write this book. And I figured they probably knew my name from when I was on public radio. I certainly didn't have any connection to them. But I found very quickly, just doing some research. So Susan Stamberg had left these papers to the University of Maryland, Hornbeck Library. And I went and I spent a week. And I just did nothing but go through her papers. I told the librarians what I was doing, and they pulled other things out for me. I found things that were not digitized, that were not mentioned in online finding aids. And so I just hoovered up everything I possibly could and went home. And that was a foundational visit because not only was Susan Stamberg so meticulous in her archives, it wasn't just her personal archives, like love letters from her husband before he was her husband, and school papers and details like that, school papers from high school, and she was in her 80s at that point. not only was she meticulous, but she was meticulous about NPR's early foundational memos. So between that and the other things that I dug up in that library, I had a lot of foundational stuff. Cokie Roberts has written many books. She and her husband have written quite a lot about each other and their relationships. Cokie has been profiled a lot. So I just dug and dug and dug, and there was so much. When these women were famous in the in their heyday in the 70s, and newspapers were at a different moment in time than they are right now. They were rich in resources, and even the smallest towns had writers who they dispatched to write profiles of people that were long, detailed, wonderfully written, rich profiles. So there was a mother load of information, and basically I just had to do what I always do, which is turn everything off and pay attention. And then I had a really lucky break in that the same friend who said, "Man, you should be writing about the founding mothers," happened to be producing a local radio show in Los Angeles where I was living and needed a substitute host. And I happened to be a former radio host. So she asked me to be the substitute host. And that was the same week that Susan Stamberg was getting a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So I said, "Okay, well, while I'm on, I just spent, a week reading her archives. Why don't we have Susan Stamberg on the show to celebrate her as she gets the Hollywood Walk of Fame star?" And Fiona, the producer, said, "Great idea." And they called up and they lined her up. And I did this interview with Susan, and Susan said, "Wow, how do you know so much?" I said, "Susan, I'm the same person you just said you won't work with on the book about Cokie Roberts or on about the founding mothers because you're too raw from Cokie's death. And I just spent a week reading your papers at the Hornbeck archive that you gave." And she said, "Wow, that you found amazing stuff. Of course I'll talk to you from now." So I went from a "we're too sad about Cokie's death to talk to you about the founding of NPR" to "yeah, sure." And then it was lockdown. And so people were locked down. So Linda Wertheimer, even Nina, who was still working at at NPR like a crazy, machine that she is, churning stories out, they were around for me while I asked them very specific questions based on all of this deep research I had done. And as any biographer finds out, memory is fallible. So I had all this documentation, and I'd call them up and say, "Hey, you were going to do a show about women, four women, like a housewife show." And Susan said, "Oh, wow, I forgot that. Wow. Yeah, tell me more. What did I say? What did I write in that memo?" So it was just, in answer to your question, I just hunkered down and hustled and triaged all this stuff because I had to get it done. And I wanted to get it done because I was going to get paid if I got it done. And that's a really good incentive, right?
Absolutely. Wow, thank you for that. That was such an insightful answer to my question. How did you keep your head on straight during your research when you would uncover men standing in the way of these women's goals or their lives or the different abuses that these women took? How were you able to, I don't know, like not get mad?
Well, first of all, I lived through a different period than these women because I'm slightly younger than they are. So I was not actively a journalist in the more contemporary and slightly modernized or more illuminated times. Basically, that's a fancy way of saying I'm 61 years old. I started working in the 80s, and it was a different climate then. It wasn't the same climate that Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie were working in. Same d different expectations of women in my time than in theirs. But to your question, anger does nothing when you're a biographer. You have to step back and look at what the facts were of the people who you're writing about and the moment in time in which they dwelled. And in fact, what I really appreciated was, as somebody born in 1963, who came up as I did when I did, I didn't know. I knew from my mother what my mother had gone through as a woman in the workforce and trying to get mortgages and bank accounts as a young woman herself. But I didn't know what women of this stature had gone through. So I found it incredibly illuminating to learn what they had not only endured and encountered, but how they pushed through it themselves. And the way they pushed through it themselves was not to say, "This sucks, I'm out of here." They said to themselves, "This sucks, and I'm sticking with it." And that is a major difference. There may be women today who said, "I'm out of here." In fact, I got a job recently as a ghostwriter because other people didn't want to work with the person because he was difficult. Now, that's not saying I'm virtuous and they're not, but I needed the job and maybe they didn't, or maybe they're higher minded than I am. But point being that to your question, it was frustrating. It was not surprising to me what the women endured. But it made what they did achieve even that much more exceptional. And what was so exceptional about these particular women was, as opposed to women who were forging trails in other professions as they were at that moment in time in the 70s, these women had a public-facing profession, as opposed to being a banker or an educator or a lawyer or whatever another woman might be doing at that moment in time. So these women literally not only forged ahead for themselves and for other women at NPR, but they forged ahead for society because for the first time, society was hearing women in a public setting talking about things like politics and governance and serious stories as opposed to quote unquote women's news. So that's how I got through it. I found it incredibly illuminating on every single level, both about learning about public radio, which people revere or revile, and these women, some people don't remember them, and on every single level, societally.
Well, you happen to be one of the founding mothers of this very podcast. What were some of the things that you were trying to do in co-creating this podcast?
Well, we were asked, Sonia Williams and I were asked at a bio conference in 2018, I believe it was. Brian J. Jones, who was, if not a founding, an early member of bio and a very accomplished biographer and a lovely, fun person, said to us at the cocktail hour, "You two should start a podcast because we need a podcast." And this was earlier days, not the earliest days of bio, when it didn't have a lot of public-facing materials. It was just sort of finding its sea legs. These newsletters that we have now are dynamite. What you've done with the podcast is dynamite, but it was just, not well known out there. So he asked us both, because we both had public radio backgrounds, to do something. I can't obviously speak for Sonia, but what I found compelling about it is I love talking to people about process, whatever their process is, whether it's the people dealing with the garbage or the people maintaining the apartment building or fill in the blank. So process to me is fascinating. So that was what was fascinating for me, was to go to the bio conference and sit down with other biographers, and there are biographers of every stripe, academic, really accomplished, popular biographers, biographers who focus on youth, every sort of biographer under the sun, family biographers, comes to this conference now. And so being able to sit down with people and ask them why they chose the subject they did and went the route they did, the way you've just been asking me, was incredibly informative and illuminating. So much so that when a program was created for people to get a master's degree in biography and memoir, I signed up for it. You're a graduate of that program that I'm in now. So I found it a really exciting way of learning more straight from biographers' mouths, how they did what they did.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That was my conversation with bio member Lisa Napoli about her book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, which was published in 2022 by Adams Press. It was recorded on Zoom on March 31st, 2025. Since Lisa and Sonia founded this podcast, we have recorded more than 200 episodes with some of the world's best biographers. For our complete library of episodes, visit our website, biographersinternational.org, and click on the podcast tab. I'm bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City.
Our executive producer is Sonia Williams. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Thank you so much for listening.